Morning, everyone. If you have a bulletin, you may notice that we're doing the books of 2nd and 3rd John today. They are books that, of course, are quite short compared to other books of the New Testament. But I've never heard any member complain about having a short sermon. Have you? I can't recall one time when I preached less than 20 minutes and someone complained to me. So fortunately, we have two short books today. I did change the order of them. We're not doing 2nd John this morning. We're doing 3rd John. I think 3rd John is a tad bit longer, so I wanted to keep you here as long as possible, although I can guarantee it won't be that long. So the book of 3rd John this morning will be our text. Let's go there together. I want to tell you everything I know about the book of 3rd John, all probably in one sentence. You ready? The Apostle John wrote it. We don't know when it was written. We don't know to whom besides Gaius. Don't know who he was. That's all I know. All right, so the book of 3rd John is very simple, very short, but very powerful considering it's probably the most personal epistle that we have preserved for our New Testament canon. It was a letter or epistle that was written from the Apostle John, probably later in his life, though we don't know for certain, written to an individual that he knew apparently quite well. And it was of such a personal nature that he called out individuals' names that Gaius would be familiar with. So it's a very personal letter, but it's good for us because we learn about what kind of relationship the apostle had with this man and how they had this friendship that was ongoing. And we see basically what we already know, that the New Testament church is a family, that we support one another, and that when there is a need that arises, we meet that need if at all possible. So, with all that introductory material out of the way, I know that was exhaustive for you. We're on to our actual text of 3 John chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. The elder. He calls himself the elder here, probably not because he was an official elder or shepherd of the church, but because he's more than likely an older individual. As far as we know, John is the oldest living apostle in his lifetime. He lived to be approximately 95 to maybe even 100 years old, if he were lucky. So he was someone that was able to continue his writing work long into his life. So the elder, talking about John, to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. So he's someone that he knows quite well, calls him beloved, and he's someone who is a Christian who is abiding in the truth. Verse 2, beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers. I love the fact that in verse 2, the personal friendship between these two individuals was such that he knew that his soul was flourishing and prospering. And here is one of the few times that we find someone writing about someone else's health physically in the New Testament. We often don't find someone being concerned about someone else's physical health. If you look at our bulletin, listen to our prayers, listen to our conversation, we are very much concerned, of course, about people and their physical needs. In our opening prayer this morning, we had mentioned at least four different people that we are praying for their physical health. And rightfully so, because we have that as an opportunity to bring that need before God. But when we find someone in the New Testament times writing about someone else's physical health, it's quite rare. So I love that we find that their relationship is such that he is writing about his physical health. Verse 3. For I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. So there was a form of communication between people that came from Gaius to the Apostle John. He heard about how well he was doing. He's remaining faithful to the gospel, and he's happy to hear that. Verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear my children walk in the truth. Now, a few comments here about verse 4. Interestingly, it could be the fact that Gaius was converted by the Apostle John himself. Paul often used the expression of him being like a father to the people that he helped convert. That could be the case here in verse 4. His children, in essence, are the people that are his offspring in the faith. He's walking in the truth. And if tradition or history is actually true, when John was very old, he would go to congregations where the Christians would gather, And he would, with his walking cane or his staff, walk up to the front of the room or the building. He would turn and he would sit and he would simply say, "My children, love one another. My little children, love one another. My little children, love one another." And that would be his sermon for the day, is that he would just remind the people that he loved to love one another. And of course, that's the most important relationship that we have as Christians. So here in verse 4, having that kind of thought echoed in his actual text, it's a good thing to read. Now, of course, so Gaius is someone who may be a convert of John. He's someone who's living faithfully in the truth. And we learn a bit more about his character here in verse 5. "Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers." What that means is he's taking care of the physical needs of other Christians and strangers, people he doesn't know if they're Christians yet or not. Verse 6, "who have borne witness of your love before the church, if you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well." Now, we find here in verse 6 is a bit more detail. The people that he's caring for, their physical needs, they're people who are missionaries. They're on their way to bring the gospel from their original location to some other location. And he's caring for their physical needs as they're traveling through. This was kind of a common thing here in the first century. And the reason why the supporting of these missionaries that were traveling was so important is, of course, because as they're traveling through this land in the first century, they have needs that need to be met for shelter, for water, for food, and so on. So taking care of them as they go through town is an important part of the work of the church. Now, one reason that we can look into our text for why was it important to look after these missionaries was verse 7 and verse 8 show us that they're going for him, they're going for Christ. They aren't taking support financially from their Gentile converts from verse 7. And because they are really working together for those that go. Again, let's look in verse 7. "Because," you're taking care of them, "because they went forth for his name's sake." So they're going forth in the name of the Lord. Therefore, it's a good thing to be taken care of by other members of the church. In verse 7, "taking nothing from the Gentiles," meaning that they were not charging the Gentiles a fee, if you will, or a salary from their converts, because they weren't trying to hinder the early church in the first century. And we find this mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2, that the Gentile churches were gathering together on the first day of every week, and they were to have a collection that would take place to support a work elsewhere. Also, 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9 both deal with the idea of gathering up that support for the congregation in Jerusalem. But the main idea behind 1 Corinthians chapter 9 in that first context is that those that preach the gospel ought to live of the gospel. So they had the right to charge, if you will, a salary of their converts, but they, like Paul, were not wanting to hinder the congregations that they just started. So they were taking nothing, no financial support from their Gentile converts. And verse 8, here's again the final part of why he was being blessed for taking care of these missionaries. "We therefore ought to receive such," these missionaries, "that we may become fellow workers for the truth." So him providing shelter, food, money, whatever it may be, to help these missionaries go and make more converts, what he was doing was supporting the work of the Lord, first and foremost. He was helping these Gentile congregations not be overburdened by paying for their missionaries to go their own way. And they were working together with the missionaries, in essence, to support the work. And that's what we do, in essence, when we help other preachers, other congregations, other missionaries across the world, is we're working with them to bring the gospel to that location. That's why missionary support is so important as a work of the church. But I want to show you one small word picture here in verse 8 that you may not be aware of. If you do a simple search for what the word is in the original Greek for fellow workers, for the truth here in verse 8. That fellow workers is just one word. And we get the English word synergy from it. Synchronized energy. It looks just like the word synergy in the anglicized version of the Greek text. It means co-laborer, co-worker, or someone who is synchronized in their efforts of working with someone. So when Gaius was supporting or helping these missionaries that were coming through his town, giving them a place to sleep, a place to eat, whatever the case may be, he was working with them in a synergistic way to bring the truth to a new area. So the easiest way I found to look at the book of 3 John is to look at the three people talked about in the text. The first one, obviously, is Gaius. He's someone who was probably a convert of the Apostle John. He was faithful to the truth, remaining, of course, increasing and abounding in the truth. And he was being thanked here to support the missionaries that were going through, no doubt, his town, working together with them to provide the gospel to a new location. That's the first person talked about in this book. And we have the most information about him. The second one begins in verse 9, Diotrephes. I wrote to the church, so it's a different epistle we're talking about here, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. To get the full scope of what that means, the Apostle John wrote a letter to this congregation that no doubt Gaius belongs to or is a part of, and this man, Diotrephes, did not accept or receive his letter. It got forwarded back, if you will. It got sent back to John. That says a whole lot about who this man is. To be able to look at an apostle's inspired letter and to say, we're not going to be receiving any more information from you, John, who walked with Jesus for 3.5 years, there's a whole lot about his character and his personality. In verse 10, therefore, if I come, the Greek has more of a tense of when I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does, prating or prating against us with malicious words, and not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. The gall this guy's got is something astonishing. We don't really find individuals called out for this kind of behavior directly in any other epistle, but we find this Diotrephes here as someone that John had to explicitly say, Gaius, thank you for supporting missionaries and their work by helping to work with them for the cause of the gospel, unlike Diotrephes, who doesn't do that himself and tries to throw people out of the church who do that. So thank you for your effort, and thank you for your work. Verse 11, beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. No doubt in reference to directly what Diotrephes is doing here, don't follow after his pattern of behavior. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. This would have been applicable, of course, to Diotrephes, but keep in mind, we're talking about the Apostle John who literally walked with Christ. He saw him. He was held by him. He shook hands with him, no doubt. He was someone that knew Christ quite well. He was the disciple whom Jesus loved, John wrote earlier in the Gospel account of John. So by him saying Diotrephes is doing evil and he has not seen God, he's being quite literal about that and, of course, symbolic in his language as well. So we have Gaius, who's someone who's a convert of the Apostle John, probably. He's someone who is abiding in the truth, helping out missionaries who have a need, working together with those truth bearers. We have Diotrephes here, verses 9 through 11, in which we find he is someone who's obstinate, who's hard-headed, who's rejecting John, rejecting those who support the truth, and is called out by name here. And then we have verse 12 mentioning Demetrius. A different guy than Diotrephes, obviously. And he's someone who we don't have a whole lot of information about besides what we find here in verse 12. Demetrius has a good testimony from all and from the truth itself. And we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true. So the question is, why bring up Demetrius here towards the very end of this letter to say that he has a good testimony, he's someone that's to be counted as truthful? Probably because he was the physical messenger of this letter. Probably because Demetrius was the guy that gave Gaius this letter and said, here, this is what John sent for you. And John wants Gaius to know, Demetrius is a good, sound Christian, therefore receive him, of course, as you would me. So it's important, of course, to see that John stood up for this man, allowed him to be recognized for who he was, someone that had a good testimony from all and from the truth, being a convert, and that he was to be received as well. Probably the most important lesson that I personally pull from the book of 3 John is not any one of those things. It's not about Gaius, not about Diotrephes, not about Demetrius here in verse 12. I think the most important lesson that I personally pull from it is in verse 13, especially in our day and age. I had many things to write, but I do not wish to write to you with pen and ink, but I hope to see you shortly, and we shall speak face to face. In our culture, in our world today, it's really easy to communicate in a non-personal way. I can send a physical letter, if you remember what those are, physical letters through the postal mail, right? Regular stamp and everything. I can send an email, which is a little bit quicker, I think. A little bit less personal, though. I can send a text message to your cell phone. Much less personal, but very direct. I can send, of course, a Facebook message if you're on Facebook. I can Snapchat you. I can use every other social media in the entire world to send a post to you and link your name in there somehow. I can tweet you, obviously. The idea is we have so many ways to communicate today that we sometimes miss the important lesson that's kind of hidden here in 13 and 14 of this first book for our consideration. It's the fact that, no doubt, John had some other issues that he wanted to talk about, he wanted to address, but he didn't think it was fit, through inspiration, to write them and send them in a letter. He preferred to do it face to face. There are some conversations that I know you would rather have with someone face-to-face rather than in a non-personal email, Facebook message, text message, phone call, FaceTime, Skype call, whatever the case, face-to-face, across the table from someone sometimes is the best place for some conversations. Here in verse 14, the second sentence, peace to you, a very common Greek greeting, charis. Our friends greet you. And greet the friends by name. A second kind of on the sideline message of what we learn from verse 14. I heard one preacher say the sweetest sound that anyone could ever hear is someone else using their own name. I didn't know what that meant until I got into local work. And then I realized when you meet someone and you're able to say, hey, good to see you, John, and they recognize that you remembered their name, that's a very sweet moment to impress upon them that you care enough about them that you know them by name. So when he says, greet the friends by name, that may be somewhat implied here as a personal relationship that they've had for a long time. So again, very short book, very simple book, but a very personal one that has some interesting little nuanced details for us to pull out and to apply this morning. If we look back into chapter 1 and we look in verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. John was able to rejoice because he recognized the message that he preached, no doubt so many years ago, was still being accepted and being reverberated through the generations of people that took his message as through inspiration and preached it to the next generation. And that message is this: that Jesus was the Son of God. He came to earth in bodily form, took upon him a physical fleshly body. He lived a perfect sinless life, but he died on that cross to be able to cover our sins and to be forgiven for all eternity. Because Jesus died, he was put into a tomb. And 3 days later, he overcame death and was resurrected, a foreshadow of all of our own resurrections for Judgment Day. If we know Jesus Christ, we obey his commandments by obeying the gospel, we have the guarantee, the promise of having eternal life with Christ forever. If we accept that message and obey it, we're New Testament Christians. If we reject it, then we've heard the word of God and we're not walking in the truth. So I want to give you the chance this morning to confirm that you are in fact a faithful New Testament Christian. If you've not obeyed the gospel before, if you are a Christian and you've wandered away from the truth, nothing would give us greater joy than to help you find your way back home this morning. If anyone has a need, please come forward now as we stand and we sing.